welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the integrative cancer care charity that helps people with cancer in the UK to learn about and access integrative medicine. My guest on the show today is Dr. Amy Walker, returning to the show for a second time. Dr. Walker is an integrative doctor, and she leads the breast cancer service at Mosaic Medical, offering holistic care to women. Amy, really delighted to have you back on the show.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
So before we get stuck into the mass of things we've got to talk about, I noticed you're in the audience at our online conference this last Saturday, and it would be great to hear your audience eye view, both as a doctor and as someone who's had cancer. Any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I have a little confession to make. I wasn't there for all of it. I kind of double booked myself, so I was also kind of tuning in and out of the Dutch London Hormone Conference that I'd signed up for. I didn't realise they were going to clash, but I was there for a lot of it, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite interesting. It was kind of a shift from last year's conference. There were so many kind of inspirational people there, and I loved how the focus was really around the sort of emotional, spiritual, sort of psychological aspects of cancer, rather than focusing kind of in on the the medical and the what can I do to my body to help support myself. And I particularly enjoyed Bobby's talk. I thought he summed things up so beautifully. I loved that concept of horizontal and vertical healing. And I just thought, he has put into words what I've been trying to kind of...
It was a very good talk, wasn't it? Yeah, for listeners, this was Bobby Sira, who's both a pharmacist and an Ayurvedic practitioner, gave a fantastic talk with slides with no words on them at all, just rather nice pictures moving gently. And he described these two kinds of approaches, if you like, one the horizontal, one the vertical. The horizontal meaning all the practical things we do about our illness, and he didn't belittle the importance of those at all. But he was really saying that without the vertical, you know, you'd missed out a huge amount of the picture, basically. And even the view you got of the horizontal from the vertical. So, very interesting. And so the vertical included all the subject matter of our conference, the spiritual, the psychological, the emotional. So, great talk, I agree.
I thought it really resonated with a lot of the things that I'm sort of doing for my own personal kind of healing as well. So, and I really loved his quote, you can't, something along the lines of, was it, you can't heal within only by looking outside of you. I think he put it in a much more beautiful way, but you have to then, but you can't just look outside of you to heal yourself. You have to look inside as well.
That was it. Yeah, very good. Yeah, no, absolutely great. A great quote. There are actually a few he had in his talk, I thought, which are really right, bang on the money in that way. But anyway, a great day. People absolutely loved it, and I was very happy with what we'd achieved, because it seems that the change in attention that's happened in the last few years has been away from an obsession with the physical aspects. Even within integrative medicine, there's been lip service for the psychological and emotional stuff for years, but hasn't really been given the weight that it deserves, I think. And it's quite clear from some of our presenters on Saturday how that aspect was actually the key aspect that really enabled them to meet circumstances which by anybody's account were almost certainly fatal. Just sheer will to live, really focused in a way that was quite extraordinary, and meant that effectively a miracle occurred.
Yeah, it's these exceptional cancer patients that Sam talks about.
Yes, I think the thing I like is that the more that the message of integrative medicine spreads, the less exceptional these are. Actually, they used to be really exceptional. Now they're like, oh, another one. No, it's like they're almost becoming to a penny, which is fantastically good news.
It's amazing news, but still kind of, I think the conventional system sort of doesn't quite know what to do with them, does it?
I agree.
Can't quite bring themselves to say, okay, well, this could be something to do with all the other stuff that you're doing. It's just sort of unexplained by traditional medicine. Therefore, we'll just kind of quietly ignore that. It's great, but we'll just quietly ignore.
Put it on one side. Yeah, well, I mean, that's a large proportion of the response. I mean, the best case response that we found that people get is from, truly supportive oncologists who may realize that he literally can't afford to look outside the box, but he recognizes that somebody's done something extraordinary, and the way they express it is, keep on doing whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's actually a huge endorsement coming from an oncologist, but it's such a tragedy that they're not allowed to be interested in what that person has done, because they're not. It's completely incorrect, and they put their job on the line to do so.
Yeah, things will change.
They will. We're going to make sure. Anyway, look, you've been on the show before, and you went into your whole story to quite a large extent about how you came to be doing what you are now. But for the benefit of people who haven't heard that, do you want to give us a kind of the potted version?
I'll give you a quick run through. Yes. Yeah. So I'm a conventionally trained doctor, qualified back in 1998. And most of my career, I was working in the NHS. Most latterly, the last 12 years of my NHS career was up at Birmingham Children's Hospital as a consultant in paediatric anaesthesia. And then in June 2021, so nearly 5 years ago now, I had a diagnosis of triple negative breast cancer, which kind of pulled the rug from under my feet, really. So very long story short, I had all the conventional treatment, the chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery. But I knew very quickly that I needed to support myself, particularly around my sort of anxiety with things that were kind of not on offer at the hospital. And I was quite disappointed that nobody at the hospital wanted to talk to me about things like exercise and what I should be eating, and how I should, how I might be able to reduce my risk of recurrence. So I kind of went off doing my own research and, through various people like the amazing Dawn Waldron, nutritional therapist, I kind of started to have my eyes open to maybe a different way of doing things. And I ended up doing some retraining with the Institute of Functional Medicine and then some integrative oncology training. And I joined up with Mosaic Medical, who are a group of functionally trained doctors. I think there's 9 of us now. So I joined them a few years ago, initially to sort of to run what we were calling the breast cancer service, that was mostly for people that had finished their active breast cancer treatment and they wanted to look for ways to reduce their risk of recurrence. But that's kind of evolved in over the last couple of years, really, so that I would say probably I still get some patients in that category. I now have quite a lot that come sort of early part of diagnosis. So we're doing more to support patients through their active treatment, with radiotherapy and chemo. And probably the biggest increase now is, I think probably the most number of discovery calls I get making inquiries are from people who've got stage 4 cancer.
Mm-hmm. So I think, it's interesting. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, to me, that's reflective of the environment, the changing climate around cancer, But maybe it's also to do with the internal matters, with the way that you organised Mosaic and what you're offering people. How much of each has played into that change, do you think?
I think some of it was personal in terms of we didn't advertise very heavily towards the kind of stage four group initially, while I was still, you know, very much in my own recovery journey and kind of the anxiety that comes around trying to sort of get back to living a normal life. And I was unsure of how easy I would find it to be a good doctor to patients that had potentially something that I could be going through. So I think that was part of it, that we kind of played down that part of the service initially while I kind of got my confidence and started to feel like I was in the right headspace and heart space to see these patients. So that was one thing. I think it also just reflects the slow but steady kind of spread of the word about integrative oncology. And there aren't many places that people can go in this country. Not really. There's a few integrative oncology doctors around, but not masses. So I think that plays a part.
I would agree. I mean, a statistic I was given recently, which looks reliable, is that around 3/4 of people with a stage four diagnosis now go and look outside the box and see what they can do. I think that's a massive change, personally. I think in the past, you know, most stage four patients got their affairs in order like they've been told to by their oncologist. And this idea that people could do a bit better than they're being suggested is, yeah, it seems to be spreading fast, which I'm very happy about because I know they could. I think that's a big change. And also with the kind of people coming earlier, that's a change that's reflected in our experience at Yes to Life over 20 years, is that originally everybody who came to us had every treatment in the book thrown at them by conventional oncology. And then they were saying, what can you do? And the answer was, well, not very much, but we're going to have a go, you know. And now we're not surprised if people have only just been diagnosed and they contact us. Which, of course, is fantastic. It's great because that's the heart of integrative oncology, is you start right from the beginning with an integrative approach. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's my favourite thing, really, is to get in really early and kind of support them right from the beginning. I think it also reflects the massive increase in kind of social media and sort of internet. Yeah. Kind of activity, because you know the all of the programs are set up, aren't they? So if you put one thing in, then you get bombarded with a whole load of other things around the same topic. So I think actually that sort of leads me on to say that one of the areas where I can really support patients is trying to help them sort of see the woods from the trees, because, you know, whilst it's amazing that we've got all these different things and things for people, and you know, there are supplements and there's IVC and there's all these different things, that I do have patients that come and they've taken it upon themselves to take 50 different supplements, and they're just drowning in information, and it's really, really difficult for people to kind of distill what actually is really important for them. And I think probably that's where I would say I've got two sort of broad groups of patients. I have patients that come, they want to do something to support themselves, but they're very happy for me to kind of guide, and you know, they really want to work on their nutrition, so I get them to see our nutritional therapist, who's amazing, and we kind of put these protocols or kind of management plans into place, and they're really happy with that and they feel confident and secure with what they're doing. And then I've got another group of patients who are actually, you know, massively well-educated in terms of, you know, they probably read more than me on certain things. You know, they read the research, they've gone down, but they do tend to, because that it's driven all the time generally by some fear and anxiety, they do tend to sort of like dive down these rabbit holes and end up getting themselves in a bit of a pickle sometimes. So with those patients, it's really much more of a kind of, it's a real partnership, and they bring things to me and, you know, we both read stuff and we go, do you know what? I think this actually would be worth pursuing for you. Or they come and I'm going, I may say, well, look, this isn't really my area of expertise, but I know someone who, you know, you might want to go and explore this a bit more with a different practitioner. So I think it's, you know, it's very individual, but broadly patients kind of fall into those two categories. And I think we've been discussing this a lot at Mosaic recently with the rise of AI and, you know, ChatGPT and things like that. You know, it's patients have put their stuff into these.
Of course they do.
So it's not, you know, there's no point in us kind of fighting against that. We have to use that as much as we can to, you know, to harness the right information for the patients. But I think where we really add that kind of extra benefit is that we've got a layer of a lot of experience, and we can look at things through a slightly more objective lens because it's not us sitting there with a life-threatening illness inside us.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, well, it's always been an issue, of course, for people, because there's always been a lot out there, and prioritizing, as you said, is one of the most difficult things. Even when you've got reliable information, that's the first thing you've got to get, is reliable information. But even when you've got that, then it's prioritizing that into what's the most important. Is very hard. And I say it's been all through our 20 years, but the complexity has ramped up amazingly in the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, just extraordinarily so. I mean, it makes what used to go on sound really simple now, in a way, when you look at the extra factors. It's all fantastic new information that's available to help, guide treatment and everything, but the complexity is mind-boggling, you know. And people, they pull up their shirt sleeves and they get on and they learn this stuff. As you say, it's amazing what people will do when they're given a life threat. You know, they will learn all sorts of things. But very interesting. Of course, we've just, as I said, had our conference, which is looking at things in another way altogether. And it asks the question, for example, well, what's driving your research? Is it being driven by just finding out the best thing to do, or is it essentially a fear mechanism at work? And, you know, there were strong suggestions that it's radically different to be looking for things that are the healthiest, most life-affirming ways of conducting yourself, or looking at things that are going to stop you from dying. looking at things to live well rather than stop you dying is a completely different place to be. So, very interesting. Yeah. You brought that up. I think that's
so true. It's two sides of a coin, but very different. You know, it's such a different sort of mindset, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, I hope that in the next sort of 10 years that with all of the sort of medical advances that are coming through, that we start to see a sort of shift in the way that people think about stage four disease, because, you know, we have a society that fears cancer, you know, so much. We fear cancer, don't we, as humans.
Yes.
Yet we know that one in two of us are going to get cancer at some point. And I think if we can shift the way that we think about cancer to something that perhaps is a bit more aligned with, living with a chronic disease rather than a sort of imminently life-threatening, you know, even if you get that kind of paradigm shift, then when someone gets that initial diagnosis, perhaps they don't get thrown into immediate kind of,
right,
you know, massive adrenaline and cortisol soup that we sort of sit in for many, many weeks when we get that initial diagnosis, and then we're waiting for test results and how bad is it and all of, and the, you know, scans and all of these things. It's awful for patients. So even if we can just kind of change that a little bit so that, you know, if you do get a diagnosis of cancer, you're not, you know, we start to think about it in a slightly different way, that, I mean, we have lots of other diseases that are like that. So I think that would be really helpful, because it takes a lot to get shifted back out of that.
Very, very much so. Yeah, an existential threat is something that people may never have experienced in the same way. So it's massive for them. And, you know, they're supposed to be dealing with all the practicalities of getting cancer at the same time when they're in the worst possible space of terror. And, I agree with you entirely. And, of course, you know, from working in the integrative space for years and with the advent of things like the Radical Remission Project, as I said, we're almost getting used to people surviving against the odds, often for very long times. It's not uncommon. And the Radical Remission Project has probably done more than anything else to put out the idea that you can do this. But that idea hasn't really got into the whole of society yet, that it's manageable in that way. It's got further to go. People can find that idea if they're looking for it, but they're not going to stumble across it. And certainly the old media/medical model is an exponential graph where you get cancer at the beginning, it goes long and slow like this, and then suddenly it starts to ramp up and it goes off the top and you die. And if you want to stop it, the only thing you can do is cut off absolutely every single cell dead at point B, and then you might survive. That's the medical model. But as anybody who's been helping people with cancer for years knows, cancer's nothing like that. It goes up, it goes down, you lose control of it for a bit, you change your protocol, now get back in control again. It's a controllable disease. It is already a manageable disease in most cases. So that message, yes, it hasn't got out yet. You're absolutely right, and it needs to. And we're keen to get it out there, actually.
I think that's so true. And, you know, that brings up the sort of this other sort of thing of hope,
yes,
which is so important. Yet I have so many patients that come to me and, you know, that their oncologists are so negative with them. And that it feels like there's still this idea amongst oncologists that there's something called false hope.
Yes, they mustn't give them hope. That's a bad thing to do.
Even when things are actually going really well. I mean, I've got one of my lovely patients. She calls her oncologist the Grim Reaper. And it's so difficult for people, because you need to feel that there's something to be positive about. And, you know, so I always say to people, you know, when I first see them for their initial appointment, I ask them a couple of questions and I remind them that, you know, there isn't any type of cancer out there that we don't have somebody hasn't been one of these exceptional cancer patients.
Yes.
Well, not me saying right. that, you know, that I can, this is what I can offer you to the patient in front of me, but, you know,
it's possible.
Just put that idea there at the very beginning of when I see them, is, I think, is really important. And it's, you know, I find it sad that oncologists don't see that it's, you can have realism and kind of be practical, kind of this is the likely thing. It doesn't have to be a mutually exclusive thing to have some hope as well.
To me, it's really interesting that the medical response has moved from fairy tales they used to tell. They didn't tell people they got cancer. They said, oh, you'll be all right and all this stuff in the past. Then they moved to this brutal, realistic model, you know, where you had to tell them like the worst case scenario based on the statistics and all the rest of it. And neither of those are true. Neither of those actually relate to what's going to happen to the person. They're both made up, essentially. But they both have this sort of protocol to them. This is what we do. And when it comes to what you described, hope, I mean, it's quite easy. If you talk about somebody as completely hopeless, you will know straight away in your mind, you see that person, they'd also be completely lifeless,
yeah,
wouldn't they? It would actually drain the life out of them if they were completely hopeless. They would be just there in a limp form, depressed, waiting to die. So hope and life are pretty much the same thing, it seems to me. You know, no hope, no life. Lots of hope, well, some life, you know, now, if not in the future. It'll change your life right now to feel hopeful. So everybody knows about the placebo effect and the nocebo effect, including oncologists. And why the hell do they use it to get the very maximum oomph out of their patients as they go for it and recover as best as they can?
I really don't know. But anyway, at least I can give a little bit of hope.
I think it's important also not, you know, the false hope thing. Because you've got only these two strategies of La La Land or brutal honesty, it doesn't allow room for the middle ground where realism and hope can both be in the same place. And you can tell somebody, if you don't tell somebody how bad their situation is, you won't muster their deepest resources to combat it. So you need to do that. You need to say, well, this is a really dangerous situation, if that's the case, so that they dig really deep, because if they don't, they won't have enough. So that part of it is necessary, but it doesn't mean there's no hope for them at all. You actually don't know. Nobody knows how that person is going to do. No doctor, anybody else, including the patient themselves. But that doesn't stop them saying, well, I'm going to give it my best shot.
I mean, I've got some patients doing really well, you know, with prognoses that they shouldn't be doing as well as they are. So, you know, this stuff does work.
It works, and it's becoming increasingly common. And it's time everybody knew that.
Yeah, well, we just keep trying to get that message out there, Robin.
Yeah, we do. Right now. Very good.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
One of the things I've sort of gathered about you is you're on a doctor journey, but you're also on a patient journey as well yourself. You're still exploring, broadening, looking at the horizons, looking at what you can develop in yourself, which is fantastic, as far as I'm concerned. It's the best. But do you want to say a bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's, I think just going back to that idea of Bobby's about the sort of horizontal and vertical healing, I think I did what most people do initially, and I was sort of looking outside of myself, you know, what can I eat? What can I, you know, what tests can I do? What can I, how can I manipulate my microbiome to kind of optimal health? And, you know, I like the science, and I found it all very interesting. So I kind of, you know, all of the nutrigenomic stuff, and, you know, I've learned so much. And, you know, I think I, alongside that, for a long time, I've been very aware of the kind of, you know, the impact of the autonomic nervous system, and, you know, how we need to have some sort of balance between fight and flight and rest and digest. So, you know, we talked last time quite a lot about my yoga practice. So I kind of, you know, I was sort of doing more than paying lip service to that side of things. But I think I sort of, where did I see it? I think I saw something on Nasha Winter's website about this program called Liberate. It must have been sort of autumn last year, and I just thought, you know what, that sounds really, and you had
Rajana
speaking, which was really, I was at that, and I thought that was a really beautiful example with that very brave lady that came on and sort of spoke.
She was great, wasn't she?
Amazing. Yeah. So I saw this and I thought, oh, do you know what? There was a bit of stuff around the breast cancer, kind of some research around breast cancer and this Liberate program. And part of me was like, oh, I'm interested in that for myself, but I'm also interested to see if that's something that I would recommend to patients. So I've just sort of coming to the end of that program now. It's quite hard to describe how it works, but they use this, what Raj was demonstrating on the Yes to Life online conference. They use this kind of witnessing thing where, you know, you have a period of time where you actually just get to speak to others, and they focus on what you're saying and nobody interrupts you. So you can kind of talk in a very kind of open way, and everyone else is doing it as well. So it kind of feels okay to speak what you are feeling. And it's all kind of, they're all strangers at that in that environment, not complete strangers, because you go through the program together, but it's not, you're not being expected to sort of suddenly say your innermost truth to your friends and family at that point. But they use a very clever app where you log things like you log these triggers, and it helps you to sort of identify what happens in your body when something is triggered you, annoyance or kind of upset, and you use the emotion wheel. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's really interesting because I have realized that I'm not very good at naming emotions, and I don't think many people are very good at naming their emotions.
I sort of have
a vague idea that I'm angry, but there's this beautiful wheel of emotions, and it kind of goes out, the spokes kind of go out. So, you know, the overriding feeling might be anger, and then it kind of goes out to all these other sort of emotions, and then like again out to a third layer. So it really helps you to kind of properly pin down what it is that you're feeling, and you make this sort of connection between the feeling, the emotion and the feeling in your body. And then over the course of the program, you start to kind of dig a bit deeper, and you do these what's called mapping sessions, which are one-to-one, which helps you to sort of go back. It's a lot of sort of inner child work. So you're kind of going back to what was it as a child that happened. And it doesn't have to be big T trauma. It can just be small T trauma. So what were the patterns that got set up in childhood that influence how you get triggered and activated in your adult life? And it's been quite eye-opening, I would say. On the back of that, I also decided to sign myself up to go on this beautiful retreat in the Netherlands called Return to Wholeness, which was a 5-day retreat for women, and it was women that had either got cancer or had experience of cancer. And it was just amazing. I would love to signpost people to this retreat. It's run by three amazing women. Dr. Lauren McDonald, you may know. She's a psychologist.
I do know her, yeah.
Emily Jenkins, do you know her? She runs
I know her.
Move, Dance, Feel, beauty yeah. company. And then Renee Hendricks, and she's a beautiful voice coach, and she does a lot of work with cancer patients, sort of helping them to find their voices again, which sounds a bit kind of odd, but lots of work through singing and music to kind of get people back in touch with their bodies again.
Renee's the only one I don't know there. The others have been on the radio show actually previously, so listeners can dig them out and have a listen. You can also listen to Raj Jana, who's been on this show as well. Yes, how interesting. So, you've been hard at it there, exploring.
Yeah, I have. And I think it will be reflected in my work at Mosaic.
I'm sure it will. That's the whole point, isn't it?
I think the focus has been so far, I guess, at Mosaic has been very much on, you know, what's your genetics show, what your blood's doing, all of this sort of stuff. And of course, that's still really important. But I definitely feel like there's going to be a bit of a shift now to kind of put equal emphasis on some of these other areas for people to explore.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, Bobby's here as much as anybody else in the conference was keen to underline the fact that what he was describing as the horizontal or the more practical stuff, absolutely essential. You know, this is not about one or the other. It's definitely about both very interesting, because I mean, there's no way that you were practicing as an ex-cancer patient without bringing in the vertical, because you were. You'd have to be, because the empathic connection you'd have with the people you're helping is part of that. That's, if you like, is generally what can be absent in our oncology appointment, is there's, in most cases, a total absence of the vertical. Because there, you know, there's the sort of clinical relationship is still sort of seen as a good thing. Detachment, and forget it, as far as I'm concerned, it's the last thing that's any help to people. But, you know, obviously you've got it's not helpful to go into some kind of a crisis of your own in front of your patient. That's not what I'm talking about. But healthy empathizing with their situation is a huge part of they're feeling cared for.
I think so. I mean, you should never underestimate the kind of therapeutic impact of a doctor-patient relationship where the patient feels heard and listened to and understood. It definitely helps that I've had that experience. I just don't think... You know, when I was a pediatric anaesthetist, I thought I was very kind of empathetic and understanding to the parents coming into the room, you know, giving me their most precious children. And I, you know, I would make them unconscious and they would ask them to leave, you know. And it wasn't really until I had my own children that I had another layer then of like, oh, okay, this is big what I'm asking you to do here. I'm asking you to trust me with your most precious cargo, the most beloved things, people. So I think, you know, it can't be underestimated, the power of having this sort of experience, a proper existential to your existence.
I think that's true. But that said, though, I wouldn't say you have to have had it in order to appreciated. I think it is largely, it's deliberately excluded from medicine because it makes it more efficient and all this kind of thing, you know, and there's an actual drive to do that, to remove the emotional, psychological, spiritual content from medicine, to make it as kind of practical as possible. And when you're dealing with somebody who's broken a leg, that works really well, actually. It doesn't matter. Somebody doesn't care too much about the other stuff. You get their leg fixed, they're like, yeah, thanks, doc. You know, but
yeah,
with something like this, it's absolutely hopeless, I think. It's just completely missing the mark. Because the person who's standing in front of the oncologist who's telling them, okay, you've got cancer and you've got 6 months to live. But that what they need help with is not with, well, when's your chemo starting and all the rest of it. That's the last thing on the list. It's all the other stuff, the major life crisis that you've just given them that needs dealing with.
Yeah, I agree. But I guess that the kind of other side of that is that until we are able to look after our healthcare professionals in a different
way,
we can't expect that they can give that much of themselves if they're not being supported and looked after. You know, their emotional and spiritual side needs to be supported as well, doesn't it? So I guess that's...
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that. That's actually what's wrong at the root of it. That's right. You can't expect them to, because they're in a war zone, most of them. So yeah, absolutely. Look, just a couple of minutes left. Do you want to tell us the news? What's happening? Mosaic, where you're going? What's happening?
Yeah, so we've got a couple of new doctors, which is brilliant. Jess, our nutritional therapist, has been doing some amazing work with our breast cancer patients with fast mimicking diet through chemo and radiotherapy. We're seeing some really positive results with our patients doing that. What else? Mosaic have just set up an early detection service. So that's for people that are well, but they want a really thorough MOT, and they want to look at, you know, we've got, there are some cancer risk sort of parts of that, but it's also cardiovascular and comprehensive gut test, things like that. So that's quite exciting. And then in terms of the breast cancer service, I'm going to the National Center for Integrative Medicine to do a course on mistletoe in July.
Fantastic.
That's kind of the next bit of the breast cancer service that I want to develop.
Yeah, great to have another place offering mistletoe. I mean, such a all-purpose, useful treatment for people with almost any old cancer. Yeah, marvellous. There's not enough of it around. Mm-hmm. There was a time when you could persuade your GP to prescribe it.
Was there not?
Yeah, there was. But, you know, the way things have gone with the homeopathic hospitals and all the rest of it, it's just gradually gone off the agenda, been squeezed out. But, yeah, anyway, yeah, it doesn't matter how much evidence is produced for it. It's not a drug, so, you know, we don't do it.
Yeah.
All right, well, look, fabulous to talk to you. Really exciting to hear about your own personal journey and how this is changing the way you work with people, to hear your experience of the people that are coming to you, which is all moving in a good direction as far as I can tell. Of increasing awareness, increasing resources for people. It's all good stuff. And the kind of box that cancer patients have been in for up till now, where it's like they die to order, told you've got 6 months to live, okay, that's it. Just make the best of it. Those days are beginning to look like they might come to the end, which would be a great thing.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, a pleasure. It was so nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
To find out more about Mosaic Medical, go to mosaic-medical.com. If you want to hear more from Dr. Amy or from some of the people that she mentioned, that's Raj Jana, Dr. Lauren McDonald, Emily Jenkins, Bobby Sira, just visit the Yes to Life website, which is yes2life.org.uk. Click the link to the Yes to Life show that's on the homepage and search for them by name on the Yes to Life show page. Also, if you missed the amazing Yes to Life online conference that we were discussing, the video recordings are now available, either as a complete set or individually. Just choose Online Store from the very top of the page at yestolife.org.uk and look in Insights and Expert Talks when you get there. Lastly, if you're interested in attending our in-person conference, Reclaiming Our True Nature, on the 26th of September in London, you can find out more at conference.yestolife.org.uk. There you can find the full programme and you can book your place. Thanks so much for listening. Please join me again next week when I'll be back with another expert guest for the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.